Good afternoon. Welcome to our panel. I'm Adrian Sanabria. I'm a senior analyst for 451 Research, which is a industry analyst firm. We compete loosely with Gartner, Forrester, those guys. We do things a little bit differently. So our talk today, we're going to cover secure coding. And we're going to talk about what's wrong with it today, you know, what our problems are today, and then we actually have some strategies we're going to share with you, some experienced, you know, some deep experience from going through those problems, fixing them. So secure coding and development, embedding AppSec into business processes. If you don't want to hear about developers and security, you know, getting together, you know, resolving that, hugging it out, you know, this isn't the talk for you. You know, so we're going to get into, going to get pretty deep into that. I don't want it to be high level. I don't want it to sound like, you know, we bought this product and we extracted value from it, you know, and leave it at that. We're going to get into some specifics, share some examples, and get down into what actually works. So here on the panel today, we have Francois Reynaud. Was previously the threat management lead for ASOS. Chairs or founded the DevSecCon.
Is that correct?
So that's DevSecCon here in the UK, right?
Not London.
To be confused with a US conference. So DevSec, you know, if you're not familiar with that, you know, security as it pertains specifically to DevOps, Agile, Cloud, those sorts of things. also spent a long time at Verizon Business, HSBC, and RSA even. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think everyone here, including myself, we have similar backgrounds. We've been pen testers, we've been practitioners, we've spent time in all walks of security, you know, before you know, our destiny led us here. Second here, to my left, is Giacomo Collini. He is the Director of Information Security for King.com.
Yep.
And that would be, you know, no one recognized King.com, I would say Candy Crush, right?
Yep, Candy Crush.
Yep. So that's got to be an interesting environment. We're going to go over some of the unique stuff that he has to deal with there. You know, mobile application development at scale, I'm not sure I would take that job. That's a scary situation to try and inject security.
It tricked me.
Yeah. So, very deep knowledge there, similar background, incident handler certifications, CISSP. yeah, I think all of us, you know, somewhere between 12, 15 plus years of experience in information security. And last but not least, Anton Karpov is the CISO for Yandex, which is a sizable organization. I think you said 6,000 employees?
It's about 6,000 employees, yeah.
Yeah, and this is one of those things coming from the U.S. I think a lot of us think the world revolves around Google. We don't know Baidu exists. We don't know Yandex exists, you know, that they're these other competing search engines in other markets.
Right.
You know, so it's a pretty big market. You know, I mean, number of users that you guys have for your main product?
Like, well, so monthly audience about 60 million, I guess.
6 million, yeah.
60 million.
60 million.
60 okay. million monthly okay. audience, yes.
So he started his career as a penetration tester and doing ISO 27000 assessments and became one of the first PCI DSS auditors.
In Russia.
So first yes. QSA in Russia.
Yes.
So I'm very sorry about that. I myself was a PCI QSA. It's rough work. All right. So let's get into it. I want to start off asking each of you, when you first came into your roles and you were tasked with application security, you know, in any role where you've done that, you know, feel free to share anything there. Where do you start? Where do you begin? What's the first thing you know, that you go after, you know, or is there something specific you go after? So I'll start with you.
Right. So after you start, you stop wiping your tears, basically, you start working. And the first thing you want to identify is, what are we trying to achieve? What is the business trying to achieve? What is the goal? What is the business goals that we are truly trying, from a technology point of view, we're trying to support? Then we've got to look at all the developers. What is the kind of training that's taken place? Is there any kind of security-specific training that's been delivered to them? Are we doing any kind of security testing within the application security, within the application development lifecycle? So that's going to be the first step. So we can understand what is the state of the mission. We can actually link all the business processes to direct controls that have been implemented, then start suppressing some of those controls. More than likely, all of the controls that we put in place were not relevant to what the business was trying to achieve. So it's really coming back and starting from what is the business trying to achieve. So that's my first starting point every time.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's an important point. Identifying the controls that are important and the ones that are less important, you know, because I think one of the problems we have in security is we tend to try to treat everything as equally as important, you know, because it's all ISO 27000, right? Or it's all in PCI. When in reality, you know, as far as the business goals go and risk, they're not equally important.
Yeah, and that's going to allow you to actually classify your data, classify your asset, and just put some appropriate control on each of them.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Giacomo?
Yeah, I have to agree that the first thing is to understand the business, and having banged my head many years trying to do lots of different things at the same time, I now privilege a risk-based approach where I can understand what's really important for the business. And so I try to understand that, and then I try to understand what kind of impact I can have on development and on productivity. I try to talk with product owners and Scrum Master, whoever is there that can influence how developers work. And I think that's really important. Also, being a former developer, I like to take a look at the code. To see how does it look and what are the most important libraries used, especially in data access or input validation. And then I start working with the teams on setting up a process if it's not there already.
Okay, Anton?
Yeah, right. So I work for engineering company, and I guess for engineering companies, developers and engineers, they pretty much understand security at, you know, from their level. So I guess my first challenge was to, establish a proper, collaboration with them, with developers and with, engineers, because, security cannot properly act as a, police enforcement unit, well, unless you are driven by compliance. But if you care for real security, you need to establish a collaboration, relationship with developers and engineers, and your security processes need to be integrated, into their processes. You cannot just hire a bunch of, red team pen testers and just, ask everyone to send them, code for you to test. Those delaying like for a couple of days, they process which are, all our processes are agile, so we, far from that traditional waterfall model. So I guess my first challenge was to, establish that collaboration with engineers, with developers, and bring in certain, level of expertise, building the team, application security team.
Yeah, so I think the common thing we're hearing here is you certainly get the big picture. There's maybe a risk assessment. You tie that back to business goals and processes. But also what I'm hearing is that relationships are very important, and to start that off right at the beginning, get that relationship with dev teams off on the right foot.
Yeah, you need to understand what challenges they're facing at the same time. You can't just arrive from a security point of view, which is, these are my best practices, this is the security policy that you need to implement. It's really about, what are you facing at the moment? How quickly do you need to deliver? What do you need to deliver? So we need to be aware of the change, the calendar change release, really. You just, when is the next release? What is the target that we're working towards at the moment? So as a security professional, you end up embedded within all your development teams to really understand what are they trying to achieve and where you can actually fit in security. You don't want to retrofit security once it's been developed. You want to start as early as possible in order to threat model your application to identify the risk and put the appropriate controls in place.
Yeah. All right, so next I want to move on to, well, and it's a natural next thing, talking about those relationships a little bit more, talking about, let's start with what the problem is already. You know, because obviously, as an industry, we've gotten off on the wrong foot already, right? With between developers and security. And the two things have been very separate, and we do tend to see things thrown over the wall. You know, here's your requirements, follow them, or you get the stick, you know, or, you know, here's your vulnerabilities, go fix it, mm-hmm. you know. And that's and to security, to a lot of us, you know, that's your top priority. Nothing else is important, you know, but fixing these things. And I think on our side, maybe we think, the solution is, oh, we just need to prioritize better, you know, and just sort that Excel spreadsheet with the vulnerabilities a little bit better, and that fixes everything, right? But clearly, we need a deeper relationship here and a deeper understanding of the processes and deeper involvement. So explain that to me. Like, why do we have the problem in the first place, and what are the key problems? We'll start with you, Giacomo.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem, for instance, coming from an organization which is agile at its core, where we have 50 plus projects running at any given time, where a project can be killed tomorrow, right? If it doesn't.
50 projects, right?
Yeah,
five zero.
Yeah, 5-0. And with a fail fast methodology, right? And so, I mean, fail fast, right? So you cannot expect, and our mission is to not generate, we cannot generate any overhead on development. So also, it's really important to work with the teams. It's really important to embrace some of the good agile concepts like ownership. Developers feel that the code is theirs, and they work a lot of the quality of the source code, and they want to be proud of what they ship, and they want to. And so I think what we should do as a security expert is to make sure they include security in the definition of done and in the definition of quality, right? Because that's what their customer wants. And trying to approach that from an Excel perspective with lots of vulnerabilities that don't mean anything to them, that won't fly much. And instead, they should own security as well. And of course, you can help. And
The developers should own security.
Well, they should be part of the equation, like everybody, right? I think security in an organization is everybody's business. That's my tagline now. Mm-hmm. And I really believe in that. Because if you try to force things to people that don't understand why you are doing certain things, they will just try to bypass you, and they will play against you. And
So I just want to emphasize something you mentioned there. It might have gone by a bit quick for the audience, but I just want to emphasize the logistics you have to deal with and the constraints you have to deal with. You say you can't slow down development. It's just not an option, right? And 50 projects. So what are the timelines like for these projects, like beginning to end?
So that's the thing. We have iteration, right? So in Agile, you may know that there is this concept of iterative development, where you can have sprints of 2, 3, 4 weeks, and every sprint can change. You have user stories, which are like features you work on, and you don't know what you're gonna work on in the next 2 weeks. So we have 900 developers, and we have 3 AppSec guys. And so when I did my first interview at King, and I was asked about software SDLC security, I mentioned, yeah, we can sit down on the pre-sprint meeting and talk about, try to map user stories to feature with the security checklists. And the guy was not really convinced, right? And we needed a wash up for me to be hired, actually, because of that. So that's the scale of the problem. Of course, there are some projects that are more critical than others, like core libraries, core platform, and that's where we can focus more.
Yeah,
but all the others, you need to try to empower people, right?
So, just another quick question, and I'll move on to want to hear Anton's response here. But with 50 projects, with the speed of these sprints, how important is it to have consistency in those libraries and things across all 50? You know, if it were just let the developers choose whatever they want to build it with. Would that be just completely unmanageable at that scale, or like how hard do you have to stress, you know, some kind of standardization across that in terms of tools used?
Yes, standardization, except for some best practices and or whatever comes from a centralized quality program that is being run by engineering, is not an option. The only thing that matters is shipping great games in as fast as possible, and if that means getting unknown libraries from nobody's nowhere, I mean that's gonna happen. So I think it's important that the person that make that decision got some security understanding and can make the call, can try to understand what's the risk. Say that what my team is trying to do is implement passive controls, like we have a new library in our repository. Let's take a look at that. Let's scan it. Let's see if there are security problems. Let's run anomaly. Let's unbox the application and try to understand, see if there are anomalies in the behavior.
Okay. Yeah, Anton, so the people, the people process, how do you...
Right. So, well, from my perspective, it's quite important to... you know, distribute security according to skills. So then I first built my application security team. I quickly realized, one specific problem. Those guys spend too much time hunting for low hanging fruits, like OWASP top 10 things like XSS or cross site request forgery. And they are skilled guys, right? So it's no reason for them to spend their time finding trivial bugs. So we decided to, split the responsibility across the whole development team, and we handed over, basic security checks to QA engineers. We developed special tool for them based on one of the open source solutions. They already had some sort of, interface to do their QA tasks. So we simply integrated that solution, and now they could just run the basic, vulnerability scan, and they train them to read results, and we train them on a regular basis. This is just an example of how to, distribute skills properly. And after that, my guys, my senior application security experts, they, have, quite amount of time to actually do proper architecture review, to step in on the early stages, not by just acting as, people say that, if you can just run a scan and read the results, that you can call yourself a pen tester. But it's actually a QA thing, I think.
So I think we're... The way I'm asking these questions and presenting these discussion points is almost covering up the, trying to create the illusion that these things are separate. But clearly, from your answer, the people, the tools, the process, the key there is that they're all integrated. And
yeah.
I think in each of your answers, it's been almost impossible to discuss any of this without talking about what we plan on talking about later. Because. Already processes come up, tools have come up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you take a brief look at the lifespan and the evolution of security in typical company, you start with basically nothing. You have no security policies. You just hire a couple of guys, and the whole security thing is more like firefighting, leading from one incident to another. And then you realize that you need to get something. In this case, if you're talking about AppSec, you need to get some source code scanning tool, and you buy the tool. This is a good thing for vendors to step in, and you buy the tool, but you quickly realize that you have some certain limitations because of this tool, and then you realize that a well-defined repeatable process is the key thing, and you need to choose tool accordingly to your defined process. And sadly, though, vast majority of companies, they stay on step two almost for forever.
Yeah, I've noticed some with AppSec, a lot of tools, the key there is, this tool only works with these three or four frameworks and languages, and then this tool may only work with these three or four, so depending on what you're using, you may have to cobble together several tools that essentially do the same thing, but for different environments, right?
Yeah, right, right, absolutely. The thing you want to have here is to have like one, maybe like one centralized interface. I mean, if I'm buying some, you know, some source code scanning solution, I don't want my developers to use just, you know, another bug tracker. I just want to have the API from that solution and create tasks in my existing bug tracker. So again, it's all about processes, right? And then you just choose tools accordingly.
So instead of giving developers a security console for a security tool,
yeah,
you know, it's just information that goes back into what they're already using.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It doesn't work the other way, because especially if you're talking about application security and you know, source code analysis. Actually, from my perspective, you have to have tool for developers, you know, not for security experts, because you know security is decided by quality, right? So it's all about quality of the code, not about like, you know, what security issues you have in your code.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's. We can talk about tools. We can talk about process and how we mature this process. Let's start with the process. I think it's better to have that before we talk about any specific tools or anything like that. Like, you know, how important is just the. So you're talking about quality of code, right? You know, I mean, how much of AppSec is that? You know, is that 70% of it? Is that 99% of it? You know, just getting that initial feedback on the code to the developers, because we have to worry about architecture and design and other pieces of it also, right? Like where's the API keys stored? You know, how are they stored? Are they protected well? You know, there are other pieces as well. So I guess, you know, how's that process work with the pieces that the developers are directly touching, you know, and then what maybe only security sees?
So I think we need to take a step back.
Sure.
So I've been working in the industry for about 17 years, and we're dealing with the same problems. So it can't be the developers doing everything wrong. We've done something wrong. We haven't explained correctly what is security. We haven't given our knowledge to all those developers. There is nothing special about working in security. Yes, we've got long hair, apart from me, and we draft scruffily. But our knowledge is the knowledge which should be available to everybody. We should give this knowledge to all the developers. We shouldn't retain it. We shouldn't just like, oh, I've got all this security knowledge, I'm going to throw over the fence all those vulnerability scanning and not explain to you what it means, but you need to fix it and you've got 5 hours. That's not how we do it. So we need to demystify security. Code security, come back to some kind of security as code. So developer, DevOps is all about infrastructure as code. We need to do exactly the same. We need to evolve on the way security has been communicated to the rest of the world. A developer should have the same security knowledge as anybody else. And that's exactly where we...
About what they do.
About what they do. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Obviously, we can't give them all the keys.
Not all 12 domains of the CISSP. Right?
No, it's 12 now. Yeah.
It's 12,
it's
right?
It's changing every day. But it's really, we failed in security. The only thing we're doing at the moment, go and look downstairs, you've got millions of appliances. They're doing exactly the same. Every one of them is a silver bullet. And from a security point of view, we just want to throw away all those ones, train the developer, explain them what we're trying to achieve. So that's the first process, which is what SANS was trying to do back in 2007, securing the human. We still haven't done it. So we need to actually take a step back here and actually, how can we communicate this information? How can we make sure that they're aware of security and they embed security? But first and foremost, we should not and we can't stop a company. If you try and stop King, for example, stop Yandex, just like, oh, sorry, you've got a security problem, you can't release today. I used to work for a betting company. You've got to work as quickly as possible. And security being some kind of blocker, arriving based on the paper checklist, this doesn't work. So we need to look at ourselves again and say, what did DevOps do for the rest of IT? This is exactly what security should do.
And I think one of the interesting things when you look at DevOps, you know, and I think initially we maybe looked at it as a trend rather than an optimization of how we do IT. You know, and I think more and more people look at it not as a trend that might come and go, but really as where things are going. And one of the interesting things I've found is I've spoken to these people, looked at how you know, people are using Agile, how they're using automation, a lot of these things. I've found that they tend to just nonchalantly fix security problems just because they're in the way. or because they, you know, they get fixed as just a side effect of improving performance, you know, and things like that, you know, where you need high availability, you need to be able to patch things in production without downtime. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you start solving security problems just as a, it seems like a as a side effect with some of the processes you need just to get code out fast.
It's a side effect, but also you can see developers actually removing authentication for the sake of performances. That's, so you've got both sides of the coin.
Sure,
here.
Sure.
That no, happens, that, unfortunately.
Thanks for keeping me honest.
Yes.
Yeah. So building that process out. I want to go beyond just maybe source code scanning. You say you do some sandboxing, things like that. You actually pull out some of these libraries. So one of the interesting things I found with our Shellshock and Heartbleed last year was that these weren't vulnerabilities in products. You know, they weren't like SQL injection. It wasn't a code issue. You know, it was an issue in a library. And generally, you know, we might have a list of assets if we're lucky. You know, we might have a list of applications we use on servers and on workstations. You know, but individual libraries, do I have a list of everywhere I have OpenSSL? Yeah. How do you handle that on the AppSec side? Understanding which third-party libraries you're pulling in and making sure those go through some sort of due diligence.
Yeah, I mean, there are tools, or you can set up your own tool. You can scan your repo for the libraries you have, and then there are open source databases that track vulnerabilities, matching them to specific libraries. You can run consistency and integrity checks on your libraries, so that's pretty key, and that's also introduced another aspect. It's that the SDLC process alone must work in conjunction with other processes, because maybe you are developing secure code, but what goes in production maybe is different, or maybe your developer develops from his dead computer, right? Which is maybe not so secure, doesn't have the same security controls of your workstation at work, and maybe you just introduce. I mean, maybe your software will make a DNS request. And if the answer is a certain IP, we'll start sending lots of packets somewhere, right? That's so you have a zombie, and maybe your Fortify or whatever won't see that because you have a DNS request, and then maybe a connection going out. It's pretty tough.
But there are some resources, for third-party libraries, open-source libraries, things like that you use. You know, that pull in some of that vulnerability yep. data, some of that, you know, this is a risky library, don't use this version, use this version.
Yep.
So do you run into a lot of issues with version control and things? Like, I know in the Java world, you know, that's the big nightmare, right? You know, we have to use this version for this piece of software, but yep. this version only supports this piece, so we need two JREs.
You know, well, that's true for many. It can be true for Python or many other languages.
Yeah.
And more unstructured is the language, more problems you can run into. And I would say on the plus side, libraries get introduced pretty early in the development lifecycle, so you can kind of catch them in an early stage and work with the development to make sure problems are fixed before we go to production.
So you've got part of your process is early on, we need to do these things. These things are critical to catch early.
I would say that given that we don't work in a waterfall with a waterfall approach, so we don't have choke points. We need to do whatever we can at any stage of the development lifecycle, so we take advantage of any opportunity we have, and the earliest, the best, right?
So how much have you been able to formalize that? Do all of you have a framework for, you know, here's how we go through this? You know, for the software development lifecycle, like how formalized is that, and how much of that is kind of something you feel out as you work directly with developers? Yeah.
In my case, the ideal scenario is that the best practice is the practice that makes the most sense to everybody. So it's the default option. That I think is true for every security control.
So that's more of a group decision.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then of course you have a formalization process, and we use a lot. Confluence, which is our knowledge base, the main knowledge base in our environment. Everybody can contribute. We have some controls there, but it's a shared knowledge base, right?
And so maybe a developer is, comes up with the idea for a security control because they're included in that conversation.
Yeah, and that's great. We like to be bypassed or outpaced by somebody else, right? I mean, we don't mind at all.
And that's one thing I found by going into DevOps and looking at talking to some of these people that don't have you guys. They don't have dedicated security people.
Yeah.
So that they're building security tools themselves to solve some of these problems. And then there's even markets out there that don't market to security professionals. They market directly to developers, but it is a security product. So I wasn't even aware of these before I started talking, and getting engaged in these communities.
Well, there is. So you were talking about DevOps, and one of the good things, one of the byproduct that DevOps gave us was this continuous delivery pipeline. From a security point of view, and I'm sure you'll agree, which it's lovely. It's basically you've got the opportunity to say, this is my immutable server, this is my immutable artifact that I've got, which is going to go through my continuous delivery pipeline, and I know this is not going to change. If it changes, I'll be able to have some feedback loop, and you start again. So we're talking earlier about the pet versus kettle. This is what we're doing at the moment, which is instead of doing incident response, once you've got a compromised server, just kill it, get another one. So it's changing the way security has been done before, which is the metrics used to be time to contain, time to remediate, but actually the new metrics are going to be time to kill and time to replace. So that's what we're going to be judged on. I've seen it. We've done it at a different company. No need to say names. But we've got a complete security automation, which is matching the DevOps methodology. So you shifted all security to the left. You shifted all your checks and your balances right at the beginning. You've got the feedback loop, which is given to the developers. There is no need, as Anton was saying, there is no need for us to look at the result from availability scanning. It's not required from a from a developer point of view to have a look at it. It's required for us to explain what it means, but we shouldn't actually be, we're not going to be fixing all these things. Those fingers are not going to touch a Kimball to actually fix those things. Mm-hmm. They're going to help you to actually find those vulnerabilities, but it's down to you as a developer to go and fix it as early as possible. So that's the overall, what you're describing as the DevSecOps movement, which is shifting everything to the left, embedding it within this continuous delivery pipeline, just to ensure that what we put in is what we get when we end up.
Okay. So let's talk about a little bit more about these opportunities. You know, the fact that we have this pipeline that we're putting in things, we're automating them. I think you had an example of. Integrating a security tool, getting that feedback to developers in real time. We're talking about, instead of fixing a server, just killing it and replacing it. So you have some experiences there?
Yeah, sure. So again, as we discussed previously, the key thing in agile companies like us is not to add extra overhead in terms of timing. So for example, the way how we implemented application security checks. So we first of all we integrated and we do certain checks upon commits and pull requests. So some specific, some critical parts of our products being checked like automatically. Second thing is, we did a lot of work to actually bring, as elaborate libraries we talked about before, to bring some sort of standardization. And actually it took us some time to explain it's not only a security benefit, but it's like everyone's benefit than if you have some something standardized like before. So we have a lot of products, right? And everything is surrounded. So every product has its own system administrators, developers, managers, engineers, things like that. So before we did our work for standardization, every team has their own build of their own version, their own build of like Nginx web server. So OpenSSL issue that we mentioned earlier, we need to run through like 50 different teams and make sure that they rebuild their Nginx version with the new version of OpenSSL. But now we have a, so what we did, we made a a site like a dedicated team to maintain like one single version, one single package of Nginx for every single product, and then they convince every single product team to use that that build instead of maintaining their own. And now they realize that actually it's quite easy for them. It saves time for them. To use that rather than just using something and maintain something on their own. As an example of that sort of standardization, which as a added value helps to increase your security.
Yeah. So I just want to do a quick poll of the audience. How much of you or your organizations are starting to adopt or currently using agile, continuous delivery, things like this? If you can put up some hands. All right, yeah. So a lot of you. So that's pretty fast. Good. Yeah. So, but on the other hand, so how many of you still have some traditional processes at the same time? It's not a full switch over, or you haven't done right. So how can some of this, and this isn't a question we planned or anything. I mean, we're playing it by ear at this point, but. How much of this can benefit a more traditional development environment? Can we take any of this back, when we're having to deal with, and do any of you have that problem where, there's still some slower traditional processes where, some of the benefit you can get out of continuous integration, you can't necessarily benefit the whole business, and you've got to have a couple different processes. It's a whole thing like, people talk about being cloud first, and you look at almost every company that's cloud first, you find, you're cloud first for your product, you still have a mainframe, you still have SAP, you still have, mm-hmm. So you've got two different data centers. One is in AWS or the cloud, and so you still have to secure this stuff.
You still have to secure this stuff. You also have to secure all the communication between those two. So that's
Between
them. So that's one of the problems is people are using the methodology and the processes they've been doing within a data center where you were controlling the boundaries of it. Now when you're talking from a cloud point of view and you're still trying to make those two work, people are still using some kind of unencrypted communication between the two because that's what they've been doing before. So it's really about, again, making them understand what are the challenges. What is the blueprint? What is your blueprint to actually move to the cloud? Which part of your application are you going to move over? Are you going to still rely within a domain controller, which is sitting in a data center somewhere? And how are you going to secure those communication? So unfortunately, not everything is applicable, but I really hope we can get there. What we can benefit from it, really, is reducing the size of the security team. And I think every CIO, every CEO will be quite happy to know that. You can actually code half of your security team. Security professional might not be happy about it, but that's where it's going to lead to, which is we need to be clever at what we're doing. And this is going to help the company achieve better release dates and achieve greater results.
Yeah, in fact, I have some of the organizations I've talked to, that have gone in this direction have actually found it easier to hire developers and teach them security to make them part of the security team than the other way around, because those... the skills to see a problem, to want to automate it, to take out those manual processes that turn into bottlenecks for the company. It's easier to find the motivation and the skills to automate those things than it is to teach them to somebody who's used to doing security the old way, I guess. So both of you, Giacomo and Anton, do you have to deal with a traditional and a you probably least of all, right?
We actually have some projects, or even not software, maybe some corporate processes that work on a more waterfall approach.
Yeah.
And I think that there are some. I'm not an agile practitioner, right? I mean, I've studied the matter. I wanted to understand. I think that key concepts are true and valid, like. It's difficult to plan for a 2 years project without having any feedback from your customers, or if your company could change business in 3 months, right? And at the same time, if you need to send a missile, a rocket to the moon, you cannot fail fast. You cannot fail at all, right? So I think every tool is good for a different job. You have to pick the right tool. What we are, I think for us, Agile is also it's a challenge. And what we do there allow us to improve our process when dealing with waterfall approaches, which is where we can have our gate, right? We can say, okay, let's go through security and let's wait for security response. And so we can do that as well, of course. And maybe we've been trained to do that more efficiently and try to go in parallel with other, I don't know, legal due diligence. We can do many things at once, right? I mean.
Yeah, well, maybe not directly answering to your question, but I have a story. We do have some traditional, you know, waterfall development in some certain pieces because few of our infrastructure need to be, you know, SOX compliant because we're a public company. One of such things is our, you know, IDM solution. We have that, you know, habit to write everything from scratch by ourselves. So we, instead of just, you know, buying some vendor product, we developed, IDM solution when we faced the
identity management.
Identity management. Yeah, that's what I mean. So we wrote we drafted the first version in 6 months. It was a time to bring it to compliance. And at that time, I had only one developer working on it, having the all, you know, root access to, you know, to, in order to, you know, move things fast. Auditors came to me and said, this guy is has root access to the machine and he's a developer at the same time. So clearly, you know, clash of the roles. So you need to have another guy who would be a sysadmin and this guy just need to be a developer. And the IDM solution, the IT management solution, you know, it was developed in Python because we're almost 70% Python at Yandex. So you can read if you have access to a machine, you can read the code, if you're administrator, you have root access, so you can make modification to that code. My question to the auditor was so wait a minute, now I have one guy who can, you know, log in onto the machine and do some changes, in the code. And what you're telling me that is not secure, and instead I have to have two persons, you know, able to log in on the machine and change code. So that's just, you know, an example of how we still need to face that old-fashioned, you know, compliance thing, yet still, you know, we prefer to, you know, rather move fast and maybe, you know, cut some corners. My auditors don't want to know that, but
and I think that's a tough one because sometimes when you get into compliance, it actually requires that you do that separation. And I've actually seen ways that companies get around that, you know, the supposed conflict of interest, you know, you can't have another developer, you know, review code. It's got to be outside for some reason or. You know, I think we do have some myths there. You know, those aren't necessarily tested or proven to result in more secure practices. So that, and it can be tough when your auditor comes in and says, no, you can't do it that way. You know, I'm not sure if you guys run into that a whole lot. You know, compliance is a challenge in building these processes and justifying them.
Again, from a PCI QSA, it's...
Yeah.
It's version 3.2, and we're finally recommending multi-factor authentication. Go on. Yeah. Really? That should have been done 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's even our best practices, like we need to change them. We need to be a bit more 21st century, and that's one of the things that we're missing. There are some great companies which are doing threat modeling for the developers before they actually start writing the code. That allows them to actually understand what risk, what control we can put in place. So we're giving back the power to the developers, which is like, look, you understand how it works. You understand what it's supposed to do. Now let's give you another aspect, which is that's the kind of threats, and we're going to explain you how it works. But you're going to be the one that's going to be able to code it.
Yeah.
That's not us. We're not as we're going to make really crap developers, really, but we're good security professionals. And good developers, we'd make actually good secure developers. So that's where we've got to go.
Yeah, and I think that's important to understand that that's part of the requirements. Mm-hmm. You know, that you hand the developer. That's part of here the threat modeling. Here are the scenarios you need to protect against.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to have that in the design phase because that might change design architecture. You know, even perhaps what language you choose to write the code in some cases.
Yeah. Talking about compliance, I mean, from my perspective, I see how, for instance, ISO 27 changed from a static approach to a risk-based approach. Mm-hmm. And even if many auditors are not aware of that and still prescribe each domain as mandatory, while, I mean, you can easily justify why some of them are not relevant for your business or why you need some more. I remember lots of clashes about antivirus in production environment on Linux servers.
Yeah, yeah.
Since that's gone now, they don't ask for that anymore. But I agree that we have best practices coming from the 70s. Some of them are valid, but some other are not there. Active Directory is not crashing like it was in the 90s. Yeah. You have virtualization everywhere. Do you need to take offline backups of all your domain controllers, or maybe not, right? Maybe if you have a couple of copies offline, it's enough. So it's I think compliance and security are different things, actually.
Yeah,
and,
no, I don't think most people would argue with you at this point. In fact, my company does a lot of surveys, and we've generally found that everyone's kind of come out of the QSA or the compliance fog, yep. and now has just a good idea of what they need to do for compliance versus how can they be secure and without while maintaining that.
Yeah. I think ISO got a healthy approach with their suite of the 27 suite, right, of standards. But some others are more...
If you interpret it correctly, right?
Of course. if your auditors help you with that, right?
Yeah.
There are some others that maybe come from a financial perspective. And I don't... Probably when you talk about finance and numbers, it's easier to be quantitative and to know exactly understand what's going on. But security stuff is... You need a lot of context to understand what should be done or not, what should be prioritized or not.
So one thing Anton mentioned reminded me of another trend I've been seeing in that, for security, especially where it integrates with AppSec and developers are involved, there's a lot more of a lot more common to see someone do a build versus buy assessment, whereas maybe 3 to 5 years ago or even less, there'd be no question. We would just do a proof of concept and decide what to buy. It would always be we'd go the commercial route. And I think in a lot of cases, people I've talked to have realized, what I need is actually quite simple and everything in the market is somewhat complicated. So I'm just going to take a developer, especially in your security staff, if you do have some skills there, I'm just going to build this piece myself. And even as a PCI auditor, I found that happening very often. People would have, the requirements seem very large and very overbearing. But if your PCI scope is down to a single server, like it was in this one case, somebody just wrote a SIM, because the requirements for what it needed to do for that one server were so small, it didn't make sense to go out and buy anything. So it's I think that's a healthy way to look at it, to have a build versus buy and actually take those requirements and say, what do I really need to be secure or to check this box and get compliance out of the way?
Yeah. I'm really jealous of Anton's IAM solution built in-house. We took a similar approach, but we found a product that was easily expandable, okay. and we are pretty happy with that. But at this time, I have two developers embedded in my team, and whenever we look at a product, we just look at API. So we never even look at the dashboard or whatever. We only care about the API because that's what we need. We integrate everything, we orchestrate, and then we build our own dashboards. As you mentioned, what we need is to have the tool to be able to support our workflow. We cannot afford to have a workflow designed by somebody else.
Right. So, if there's any vendors in the room listening to us, just to read once again, we don't want shiny interfaces. We want rich API to be able to integrate your tools into our workflows. Thank you very much.
And I'm not going to mention any vendors, but I hear that from vendors as well, where vendors are trying to decide where their R&D money is best spent. And in a lot of cases, they have to decide, are we going to focus on being a good source of data, or whatever their product does, or having really, intricate analytics and nice console and good workflow in that console, because those are two very big projects, especially for startups, security startups and things like that. So in a lot of cases, I hear from vendors 75% of our customers have never logged into our console. They pull the data straight out of our API,
yeah.
into Splunk or into, you know, whatever their workflow, existing workflow is, a ticketing system, an IDE for developers.
Well, I think you've got to, we're talking about automation here. We're talking about let the machine do the job, really. We've got to use the power of the compute, really, in order to eliminate those little hands which are creating problems. It's the human always clicking on the wrong button which is going to do that. It's going to be the human which is clicking on a link which is going to end up in a CryptoLocker infection. So it's really about what do we do with this human? And there is a trend that we're seeing. So you're talking about best practices from the 1970s, and one of them is coming back, that's trusted computing, which is, so we spend the past 10 years going like blacklist, whitelist, I don't know which one we're going to use. It's whitelist. It's basically a trusted computing. I'm just giving you those five binaries that you can run on your computer. Point. Okay, it's a bit limiting the amount of gaming that you can do. You can't chat to your friends online, you can't go on Facebook, but that's how we can protect the companies, which is going back to basics. If you want to chat to your friends, you've got your phone. Everybody's got a phone when they've got the ability to do that. Let's go back to what, you're here to do your work, you're here to do A, B, Z, let's just do it. I don't want to turn security into some kind of Stasi or anything, but it's really about, let's go back to the basics and understand why have you got all those tens of antivirus, as you were saying. You don't actually need an antivirus, maybe, if you know, actually, that only those three binaries can run on your box. What's your danger?
Yeah.
There's a few added, a few caveats here. But it's really, that's a trend where you're seeing a bit downstairs. They don't know how to sell it yet, because where do you make the money?
Yeah. Yeah, so I've actually seen a Docker security product do exactly that. It records what happens when you run your application, and it uses that to whitelist. It then locks it down. Like anything, any other binaries, anything else on that, even behaviors, activities on that box, or in that Docker container that weren't seen during the recording just are not allowed to run. So you cut down your attack surface that way. So I'd like to get your key takeaways, and then we'll take some questions before we have to end here. You know, you're talking about the human part there. Does that kick yours off?
Yeah, I think, trying to think what I said earlier. I think it's about...
You wrote it down.
I wrote it down, but it's over there. it's all about securing the human just to ensure and giving them the tools, giving them the skills for them to develop. In order to allow them to threat model the application for themselves to realize what risk is and identify as early as possible. So it's really, let's give them a tool, let's give them the knowledge, and they will help security in the long term. But it's all back to human.
Okay.
Yeah, for me it's understanding the risk and the business and performing a threat analysis on your business and so that's the first thing, and then work with people, work with everybody and get buy-ins.
Anton?
Well, a few things from me. So first of all, try to blend in security into your existing processes. Do not put it aside to oversee. Second thing is, focus on your processes, not on the tools. And third thing is, try to distribute skills accordingly. Do not assign the whole stack of application security tasks to a certain team. Try to distribute it across the whole development team, including the quality assurance engineers, stuff like that. So maybe that's it.
Good stuff. Do we have someone with a microphone? Yeah. So we can take questions now. Yes.
Some people, I'm Rolf, by the way, I'm from software testing and application testing. One thing we tend to use, I'd like to use, is maturity models. And also for application security, there are maturity models designed by OWASP and build security in. Did you use them before in communicating with the management, and will you be using these maturity models again?
Who wants to take that?
Go on. I can take that. In our case, for instance, we develop mainly mobile applications, so the OWASP.10 is not always so relevant. So I've used that in the past, and so I think it's valuable. It's a valuable source, and metrics are a hot topic, right? And maturity, I think, it's a big help on measuring how your controls behave. So it's your control doing what it's supposed to do, and then it's audited, monitored, et cetera. I think you can establish that scale and understand if the control is operating correctly, but cannot be a generic approach. Must be tailored on your business.
Yeah, I can add on that, if I may. Yeah, so from my perspective, Avast Top 10 is just a document to read. I mean, just it exists for you to just to go and read about, you know, top 10 security issues for web apps. But you know, in your company, you really need to focus on most critical things. Like, for example, we have some experiments. You know, some mobile apps, for example, which we write just to see, you know, if they can, you know, we can just use it, build a new product or not. And for example, you know, for these guys, we don't really, want them to follow, you know, all security practices which we have in our company. But for like, you know, most critical, parts, most critical products like, you know, Yandex Webmail or our authentication services, you know, require them, you know, the tool thing. So it's all, I mean, it's all stars. It's all about, attacker model, which is, you know, relevant to your case. And documents and standards such as OWASP is, you know, just a handy tool to use.
There is, we use them as well. You've got Cubit, you've got SOM for security operations, but it's just, what do you do with them? So you end up, so you created your metrics, as you were saying. Metrics is just the effectiveness of your controls. And they're all green. What do you do with them? Do you change them? Do you just accept it? And it's just, yeah, perfect. We're good here. No, you need to change the threshold here. So you need to constantly reevaluate yourself. And when you reach the top, actually, that's not the top again. It's your turn to actually change for a new type of security model. For what is my maturity? Where do I want to go? If we're talking about the OWASP Top 10, if any of my clients talk to me about I've been hacked by an OWASP Top 10, they say, that's not a hack, that's stupidity. And that's where we need to mature ourselves again, really, which is there is not a security maturity model which is really looking at the overall security posture of a company. That still needs to be built, so let's start creating it.
That's a good idea. Not talking about the OWASP Top 10. That's a whole different project. That's the vulnerability.
They have a maturity model project?
That's the maturity model is really the activities you should do during secure software development.
Yep.
So in design, development, testing, nothing to do with the vulnerability. But thank you for your answers.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think we used up our time on that one question. We'll be around. You can come ask us after the talk. But I appreciate everybody coming out and coming to listen to us talk about this topic. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.